listeners, and welcome to the podcast. I'm your wilderness survival expert and dirty van hippie, Amelia Fisher.
And I'm Sarah, and I have yet to touch a sick person in any capacity, but I'm learning how to.
Bitch, you have spent a lot of time with me, and I get sick fairly often.
That's true! I've nursed you. I have nursed you through so many debilitating illnesses of your own foolish creation.
You're gonna do so well in nursing school. You've already seen it all.
So anyway, one of us here, though, is a liar, because one of us isn't currently living in a van. Do you want to say anything about your shame, Amelia?
I was gonna keep that on the DL, Sarah. I can't believe you're calling me out like
yeah,
this.
Yeah, call out post. Your fave is problematic. Doesn't actually live in a van at the moment. Is sleeping in a real bed as we speak.
I have slept in a real bed for the past 3 nights, and you know what?
Horrifying.
It sucks. I don't like it. I wake up and I'm like, oh my god, there's so much space. Oh, I like reach out my arm and I don't feel the ceiling. Like, what's going on here?
I smell the smell of people, and it's not me. It's not my own recycled musk trapped in this metal can with me.
Oh god, it's not the smell of every air freshener that I've sprayed for the past 5 months slowly poisoning me as I sleep.
God, are you literally just layering Febreze over Febreze over sweat over Febreze?
I mean, yeah. If you could divide the air the way that you could divide, like, the Earth's crust, there's a whole history of smell going on down there. A history that no one should ever read.
Oh, hey, dark and uncomfortable histories segues pretty well into our book, you know?
You're right.
I think I did
it really does.
Pretty good. It's pretty good there, huh?
It's dark. It is sort of about history.
And you know it smells so fucking rank.
Oh god, yeah. The smells that are described in this book will raise the hair on your fucking head and then possibly make it fall out.
Spoiler warning, you can't shower that well in the Arctic.
This week, author Dan Simmons is taking us on a fun-filled expedition into the Arctic Ocean. Which is really only accurate under a loose definition of fun, like a definition of fun which includes your dead body being eaten by your friends kind of fun.
Which is your definition of fun.
Oh yeah. The novel is called The Terror, and it is a fictionalized account of Sir John Franklin's ill-fated polar expedition in search of the Northwest Passage. Which, by the way, I think it actually is a real thing, Sarah. You definitely told me that wasn't a real thing.
Okay, we'll get to that. We'll get to that. We'll get to the walk of shame that I'm gonna have to do regarding the historical accuracy of this novel. Just keep going.
All right. So, the book, like I mentioned, is fiction. Mainly because it contains slightly more demons than I would assume the real explorers may have faced. But, hey, we don't know!
We don't know! We can't ask them!
So, it follows, the captains Sir John Franklin and Francis Crozier, the captains of the ships Terror and Erebus, which, like, pretty baller name for a ship, right? Like, you know you're off to a good start. Or rather, you know that you're probably gonna die, but in a really cool way. Like, the ship's name is the Terror. Like, that's pretty good.
I would have gone with the ship Warm Ship.
The good ship Warm Ship. Although, then again, doesn't it make it kind of worse if you freeze to death on the ship called the Warm Ship? Like, that layer of irony is almost a little too sickening.
Is it more so than dying on a ship called the Terror? You're gonna fucking...
That's not irony. That's just, like, what the fuck did you expect?
Actually, yeah, that's not ironic. That's like, oh, yeah, should have seen that coming.
Yep. I guess you're right. I mean, I think, really, the important thing here is you just shouldn't go to the fucking Arctic. Like, let's just start off with that. I mean, even now, things are not great. 19th century Arctic exploration? You have disease, starvation, polar bears, weeks without sunlight, ice which will squeeze a ship's hull until it pops like a zit. Like, what is possibly up there that anyone would possibly want?
And let me put a little asterisk next to that. Don't be a fucking European guy who's like, yeah, I probably know how to survive in the Arctic. You don't! You're gonna do very badly! We've done it okay, but, like, half of our stories of Arctic explorers are like, and Ernest Shackleton, against all odds, didn't have anyone die. And we're all like, damn, Ernest, that's the best we can expect.
I liked that line from the book where one of the characters describes a different Arctic explorer as being knighted for incompetence. And I couldn't find
England.
Any information. I couldn't find any more information about that, but I did appreciate it. God, I mean, even in a best case scenario, it's like, you get there, no one dies, you look at some mountains, and you come back alive, and you're like, yep, that's there. Dozens of lives were lost.
I can't believe that you are critiquing the very idea of adventure and exploring. Have you been, being out of the van for a scant 4 days done this to you?
Listen, I'm in the lap of luxury here.
You're in a haunted basement.
A climate-controlled basement. Granted, the climate control itself is also part of the haunting, I believe, because there's this sort of, like, gurgle, like somebody trying to breathe after they've drowned to death, you know? And then this, like, kind of rattle, like somebody is trying to breathe after they've inhaled a lot of smoke. Like, what's this ghost's deal, man? You should really just settle on one aesthetic. I mean, it's really just confusing me. I'm like, get your shit together, basement ghost.
Yeah, pick a fucking aesthetic. Like, Arctic terror, to get back to our point.
Yeah. And speaking of aesthetic, this has gotta be the most hashtag aesthetic ship ever, okay? It's like a floating box of claustrophobia and darkness. I love it. It's like, so much of the space in this novel is spent just with these lingering descriptions of how fucking terrible this place is. Terrible. Huh? Get it? Huh. Huh.
Oh my god. Oh, slam dunk. Oh, boy.
Yeah, that was good.
High-level novel commentary. Anyway, don't go to the Arctic. And if you are going to go to the Arctic, don't bring your grandfather clock. And, like...
yes, seriously?
All the descriptions of these things these English officers brought. Writing desks, thousands of books that apparently none of them thought to read, even though they all have titles like How to Survive in the Arctic if You Are Dumb and in the Arctic.
Yeah, which one of these ice floes is actually an island that you can sail around? And they're all like, sounds fake.
God. Like, I don't want to, like, I would die. Okay, let's get real. I would die instantly.
Oh, yeah. I would die too.
But I wouldn't go. And I think that's the important thing to talk about here. I wouldn't go. I wouldn't try. You know, I wouldn't dream.
And see, that's my problem, is that I know myself, all right? And honestly, I say don't go to the Arctic, but my heart says, bitch, if you were born in the fucking 1900s and you were also a white man in England, you'd probably go to the fucking Arctic, okay? That's just, like, who you are.
You'd probably be like, yeah, I can do this. Also, we did go to the Arctic.
Oh, God, you're right. I literally have a bumper sticker on my car.
We literally tried to drive to the Arctic Ocean, and it didn't work.
Oh, my God.
We're the fucking terror, Amelia. I thought you knew that was the joke.
Oh, my God. Okay, so now, you know what? This is very exciting, because I can now call the van the terror.
El terrore.
It's actually kind of accurate. No.
El terrore.
I was waiting. It's not
Italian
even El terror.
Spider-Man.
Okay? That's not. We're not gonna quote Italian Spider. No, okay.
Respect la donna.
Italian Spider-Man. Which, hey, they did not. They did not do that.
They did not respect la donna, and did not work out well for them. But before we get into a deep examination of the themes and the style and the different questions this book raises, because I think there's a lot of interesting stuff to discuss here, I do want to know off the top how quickly after the point where, like, we're mildly inconvenienced in the ice, would you begin eating your fellow crew members? Go.
I love the fact that you assume that I would wait until we were actually stuck in the ice to start eating people, okay? I'd be like the person that they find before we have left sight of the Thames, who's just, like, eating someone on the fucking orlop deck or whatever they call the lowest part. And they're like, oh my god, Amelia, what? There's plenty of canned food. And I'm like, I've heard of botulism. I don't know what it is, but it scares me. So I ate my friend.
And I would be the person that they had to drop off in Greenland because they're like, you literally have to eat the canned food. And I'd be like, nah, it looks gross. Like, you have to eat it for calories. Like, no, I'm good. I'm not hungry. I'm good. Like, you're literally starving to death. No, it looks gross. The texture is weird. Amelia gave me some weird meat.
Really? You don't want the weevil biscuits?
Jesus Christ, the descriptions of all of their food make me so, sad.
I can't even really, I feel like I've blocked them out of my mind because they're all just so gross. It's all just like, oh hey, we ate food that was canned incorrectly, so it literally paralyzed us. Fun times!
Fun times. The death was very slow.
God, that sums up the entire book, honestly. That's true. The terror. The death was very slow.
It did take about 766 pages to kill everyone they were going to kill, you know?
Yep. But I mean, that is something that I really liked about this book, is it really took its time. But once you kind of got into the pace of it, I was like, even though you know that these people are probably all going to die, like, every time that one of them is in danger, you're like, no, come on,
I liked that one. Oh, I liked that one. Oh, also, hey, survival tip number one for surviving any kind of just expedition. When predicting survivability rates, it does help to know that this is based off an actual event. The entire time, I was just like, oh, I bet some of them are going to make it and come home to England.
Hey, fun fact also, Sarah, I literally told you multiple times that one of my ancestors was on the crew that went looking for these ships in real life when they went missing. And I was like, it's so cool that I have this personal, real life, actually exists connection to this book that I enjoyed. And you were apparently like, yeah, what? I'm sorry, I was playing Dragon Age.
Here's the thing, I almost certainly was. And that I just assumed, I don't know, I just heard, like, my relative looked for people who got lost in the Arctic. And I was like, I bet that happened a lot. Oh, I bet that happens all the time.
I'm sorry, Sarah, but I'm pretty sure that I was also jerking off at the same time by being like, this ship was called the Terror. It's so cool. Such a cool name for a ship.
You know what? I will accept a certain amount of conversational negligence on my part. But let me tell you, I feel like it really added some suspense to the book that would not have been there if I'd used my fucking brain for a goddamn second.
That's true. I mean, I think that's kind of a lesson to be learned, is if we all just stopped thinking so much, then maybe we'd all have a lot more
fun. I know, me reading books about the Civil War, like, who's gonna win? You know, it's like, we lose so much when we actually know things.
Yeah, like, who really wants to know what the fuck is going on at any point? Not me. I live in a van. I avoid all media.
While I get texts from my friends who are like, can you believe this bullshit? And it's like, what fresh bullshit is this? Sorry. I know I just zoned out thinking about how terrible the world is.
Anyways, let's talk about how terrible the 19th century was.
Not good.
No, okay, honestly though, I think one of my favorite parts of this book was when all the characters were like, yeah, so you know how we've been trapped in the ice in the Arctic for 2 years, and, our food supplies are going bad, and, we're almost out of coal to heat the ships in negative 60 degree weather, and, we have no fucking idea where we are? You know what we really need right now? The Mask of the Red Death!
Yes!
Oh my god, that was like my favorite part, because I was like reading this, and I was like, oh my god. These characters are trapped in the Arctic, and their cool plan is to put on literally a carnival version of the Mask of the Red Death. And I'm not joking when I say it's my favorite part, because it's fucking insane, and I love that.
Would you be that bitch hanging out in the last room like, yes, yes, death comes for all of us. I'm eating crew members as we speak.
For our viewers at home. The final room of this super cool, fun Mask of the Red Death.
Out on the ice that they spent a lot of time setting up. They spent so much time setting up.
Background info. These characters decide to put on this mask and
Charade.
They spend a bunch of time. Masquerade. Yes, you're correct. Thank you, Sarah. Where would I be without you?
You wouldn't even know that the Franklin Expedition was a real thing. I had to tell you that.
Actually, that's one thing that I would know. These characters spend a bunch of time dyeing sailcloth and doing all these crazy preparations. I forget why they have costumes, but then again, they brought, like, a massive library of 1,000 books and not enough food. So the fact that they just had masquerade costumes, I'm like, yeah, okay, that sounds legit. So they put on the Mask of the Red Death. They have the colored rooms and everything. And in the final room, which is dyed completely black, staining the ice with soot and black sailcloth and the black sky, which has not seen the sun for weeks above, contains the clock of the dead expedition leader and the severed head of a polar bear, which is the shape of the demonic creature which is hunting them. And let me tell you, I just love that.
I love the reading it from the perspective of the captain of this expedition going through all these rooms, being like, okay, no, we can't do this one.
Ooh, this was a mistake.
Oh, I should not have given them access to our masquerade costumes. To be fair, Crozier, as one of the only people on this expedition who seem actually invested in surviving and, like, with a common sense, was always like, maybe let's not do this expedition. And there's, like, about halfway into it, he's like, why don't we turn around and go home, because this isn't gonna work. And that's just, like, him constantly offering good suggestions and people being like, no. And then later being like, oh, yeah, we should have.
Well, even in the very beginning of the book, before Sir John Franklin even leaves England, one of the older polar explorers is talking to him about how his expedition is, like, so poorly prepared. And he's like, you have enough coal to steam for 12 days. And you have enough food to be up there for 5 years. I'm noticing a bit of a discrepancy. And the 12 days of coal is actually historically accurate, by the way.
Horrifying.
A lot of this book is historically accurate, which is interesting. And the whole time Sir John Franklin is like, this conversation is really awkward. I hope I can stop talking to this guy really soon. Which also, like, same.
Same. I think that was him dreaming.
I'm pretty sure that really happened. I think he was dreaming it, but I think it also really happened. That's also kind of a theme in this book.
Boy.
Is just being like, is this real?
Is this real, or is everyone starved and terrified? Speaking of the fact that a lot of this book is historically accurate, I would love to discuss the parts of it that are necessary fabrication. Not the demon, which I think we all look at the demon that is stalking the ice and go, he might have added that. The author might have added that. But he does also...
Fun fact, actually, my ancestor
shut
told
the
me he
fuck
wrote in his whaling diary.
God damn you. But just the fact that he had to necessarily add a lot of personality to characters, like, you know... Ooh, boy, want to hear me bluff my way through some naval terms?
I cannot
like
wait.
The normal soldiers, and then the...
Sorry.
Then the Marines.
Because you didn't even say sailors, you said soldiers.
Fuck! But, like, there's a lot of people on the ship that are all given... there's a lot of viewpoints that are going on. Crozier is the main character, but he's far from the only viewpoint character. And in fact, there's viewpoints that come in and out of prominence as the book goes on, as some characters die and other characters sort of take over their slot in the point of view rotation.
I did like how Dan Simmons was just like, yeah, I'm not gonna allow any death to go explicitly explored. He's like, oh, I've never had this character as a POV character before, but they are about to die horribly, so I guess I'm just gonna jump on into that.
Or they're about to not die, but their life is gonna get a lot worse, so let's just jump on this now and follow that train until they do die. I think that's really important for me. And so in a lot of cases, I think the characters are characterized fine. And I'm talking not even fine as in, like, good characterization from a novel point of view, but how pissed off would I be if I was a ghost who was reading this about myself? Crozier comes off pretty well, although there's a lot of stuff about his romantic life. That's just sort of this interesting question of, like, I constantly think about this when you're fictionalizing historical events and you're adding sexual relationships, embarrassing, like, anecdotes that didn't, we don't know if they happened or not, or, like, I don't know, anything super personal, or I'm just like, it's odd and I wonder about the ethics of this.
Dude, I'm totally there with you because I read a memoir where somebody talks about something awkward or sexual and I'm like, I'm not comfortable with this being included. I don't know. I mean, like, what would the person that this happened to think?
No, dude, you should hear my thoughts on memoir, which is like, was that your story to tell? Because sometimes you're just telling anecdotes about, like, people who are related to you and it's just like, oh, they didn't ask for this, you know?
And Dan Simmons is like, I don't even know these fucking people. I just thought it was cool.
I know. And specifically, I'm thinking about Cornelius Hickey, who goes on an interesting character arc that starts with a manipulative sodomite, to use the term of the book. He has a complicated relationship with a character named Magnus, who is depicted as an idiot in the 19th century medical sense, as someone who is intellectually impaired and has a very childlike mind. And it seems to be, from Magnus's point of view, a loving relationship, and absolutely not from Cornelius Hickey's, who's apparently a known serial, like, molester and abuser on ships like this. And his arc, that's pretty much the best he ever is.
Yep.
He goes full Amelia by the end of it.
Okay, please no.
Really? You don't see yourself crowning yourself as a cannibalistic god among men?
Yeah, now that you mention it, I guess I really can't say no to that.
But none of the weird sex stuff. You wouldn't do that. You would just eat them.
Yeah, exactly.
And not in a sex way. Once again, you just eat them in a non-sex way. You'd stress that to them as you were eating
I mean, really, though, like, if you're gonna have cannibalism, if it's, like, sexy cannibalism, you know, like, maybe that's okay.
Is that why you originally picked up the tarot? You're like, it's pretty long. There's a lot of space for a lot of stuff to happen in these pages.
Literally the reason that I picked up the tarot in a used bookshop knowing nothing about it was the title was cool and the cover was cool, and I'm like, this book is $1, that's enough for me.
Nice. McKay's?
Yep, you know
God bless that warehouse of used books.
That's where I'm going to get 90% of my reading material for this podcast.
I'll get it from the library because I support our local government, specifically through late fines. Boy.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure you're, like, literally the reason that Virginia libraries are currently in operation.
FCPL? Hey, guess how many books I have checked out at this moment right now, at this moment in time?
I'm not going to guess because I know I'm going to lowball it, and I'm going to think as I'm saying the number that I'm highballing it, so please just
No, please, give me a number. Just give me a reasonable number.
Oh, you want a reasonable number? Because a reasonable number is not the number of books that I think you have checked out, Sarah.
45!
Are you kidding me? I was going to say 20 and think that that was too much. Oh my god. Don't make me come back there. I will drive across the country back to Virginia.
To do what? Return my books forcibly?
Just help you read them. You know you're not going to get through
them. I'll do my fucking best, Amelia. Believe in me. Believe in me for a goddamn second, maybe? Maybe?
I would believe in you if there was precedence, okay?
Hey, I read a lot of books. I've read almost many books this year, so...
You're right. You probably read, like, 15% of the books you check out of the library, and that is a lot.
And here's the thing. It really... I love shopping. I love shopping so much, but I have an income stream that is basically your mother asking me if I want to watch your cat for a bit. So I can't go shopping, but I can go to the library and think, I'm taking this book from someone else for free.
Really? Is that what really gets you about going to the library? You're like, somebody else could be enjoying this book, but they won't.
Catherine was giving me such shit for checking out so many books, because she's like, you're not reading them, you're just hoarding them so other people can't read them. And as she was saying that, I was like, yeah, I guess I am.
They don't deserve them like you do.
Yeah, they'll probably read you. I'll look at you.
I appreciate what's on the outside. I do judge a book by its cover.
And nothing else. Speaking of judging things, I guess, the book, El Terrore.
Every time you say that, like, 10 minutes are knocked off my life, just so you know.
Terrore.
Because I think of Italian Spider-Man, Italian and then that just...
Spider-Man.
Can we talk about the book?
Respecta la donna. Boy, I should have rewatched that video before we did this. I think I hit up all of my quotes from Italian Spider-Man.
All two quotes
Actione.
From Italian Spider-Man.
Actione! Nice.
I agree with you, though, about the sort of question of whether or not it's actually ethical to take this historical... Well, I mean, we really are kind of debating whether historical fiction is ethical. And I will be real with you, this is basically the only historical fiction book that I can remember reading off the top of my head. So, you know, I think you might have more experience in that regard. But
here's the thing, I really don't, because my experience... I don't read that much historical fiction. I read a lot of history. Not to sound like okay, elitist, I read a lot of major. Historical nonfiction. So... It's always this weird sense of my only sort of approach to history is, as opposed to my approach to fiction, where I'm thinking about characterization and plot and theme and all of that, my approach to fiction, to history has always been with the acknowledgement that every piece has its own bias, and bias is also like just another term for point of view. You know, there's no way you can write objectively about history because you're always choosing what to include, what not to include, what you think supports your argument, what arguments you also put in there. It's like sort of necessarily by framing information, you're deciding what is useful and what is not. And so it is this constant sense of like, how do I, from my limited perspective, correctly portray these events in a way that is fair? And fairness is a really bad way to think about narrative sometimes. It's not, you know, to say, like, I don't know any of these men, so I can't make any of them villains. You know, that would not be a good novel. It wouldn't be a good novel to say, like, well, especially for some characters like Cornelius Hickey, who was a real person, and who I think the sum of what we know about him was that he was a Cocker's mate, and that he had a knife on the ship. Like, when I was Googling, that was really all that came up. And so there is this weird sense of responsibility of, like, this is maybe the most in-depth writing he'll ever get. And is that fair to him, that it's this, where he's pretty evil?
Yeah. And, you know, I'm not really sure. I guess, because it's funny when, even though I knew, from the first time that I read this, that it was based off of real
stuff.
Let
me talk about the sanctity of history for a bit. It's important that you not know it.
But I mean, I didn't even think about it. I wasn't like, hashtag yikes, these were real people. I mean, I was just kind of like, yeah, all right. And I'm honestly still kind of like that.
Yeah, and I think that's totally fair. I think because it's an entire genre, you can argue. I mean, they're dead. They're never going to read it. Like, I don't think people who are going to read The Terror are like, this is an extremely accurate portrayal of all these people. But at the same time, when I was looking up the Wikipedia entry for Crozier, and like his picture came up, and I was like, oh, that's my boy! And I was like, oh, no, he's not. I read a fictionalization of him, and I don't know any facts about him, so that's why I'm here for this Wikipedia article.
Yeah, yeah. I liked Crozier a lot.
I liked him a lot, too.
That one description of him as stiff, awkward, melancholic, and slightly inebriated.
Aw, that's you!
Like, I know, it's me at parties, every party I've ever been to, so...
Other characters I liked, I really liked Bradley, was that his name? Bradson.
Bradley?
Oh god, the steward. The steward character,
Gee, it's almost as if you should have written this down.
I should have. I had it written down. Fuck you. I liked Good Sir. Good Sir is a different character that I liked. I liked him a lot. He starts out...
Bridgens. Sorry.
Thank you. Two characters I both liked.
I liked Blanky, the Ice Master.
Oh, yeah, the guy who refused to die.
Yes, oh my god. He like, gets his leg bitten, but not bitten off, but then something else happens, and he has to have his leg amputated. And then, like, all this stuff happens to him, and, like, he's just so...
He has to keep getting his leg amputated.
Yeah. And like, there's this one quote by him, which, I'm gonna read the dialogue tag first, and then the lines, so that I can really, really, hammer it home. So the dialogue tag is, Thomas Blanky said almost cheerily, and the dialogue is, it's as if there's some dark god who wants to torment us! I was like, I like you. That is one thing, though, because about Cornelius Hickey, where, you know, he's described as being this sort of sexual predator mm-hmm. on the ship, which, as I was reading it first, I was like, oh, this seems really homophobic, you know, mm-hmm. like, oh, yeah, sure, the most evil human character is also the character who is portrayed to, like, I mean, I wouldn't even really say, like, be in a gay relationship, but then you also have... introduced later the characters of Stuart Bridgens and Harry Peglar, who are also, they were in a relationship, mm-hmm. And it was like a very good and emotional relationship, and I liked the way that section was written, and you know, they kind of mutually broke it off later, and so at that point I was kind of like, all right, Dan, we'll see where this is going.
We'll see. And what I liked about Briggins and Peglar, besides the fact that I thought they were two genuinely good men, in something that that's something I always appreciate in survival novels, because I feel like it's really easy to make. One of the things I liked about The Terror is that there were very evil characters who were, like, definitely themselves above everyone else. But there is also a tremendous work ethic on the ship of everyone together, everyone's in this together, no one's going to survive in the Arctic alone, you know? And so it wasn't, there was constantly that tension of maintaining discipline on the ship. But it wasn't like every character was like a fucking season of Survivor. Like, someone's got to get the immunity idol, vote off the island. I've never seen Survivor.
I haven't either. I have no idea what you're talking about. Anyways, I have a cool survival tip.
Ooh.
Based off of this book.
Ooh.
And that survival tip is, a lemon a day keeps the scurvy away. scurvy is terrible. Scurvy is fucking horrifying. I have some, like, medical information about scurvy. I don't know if you also looked that up, being, you know, medically inclined. I don't want to steal your thing.
Well, why don't you go, and I can jump in, because the thing is, I actually did a, I didn't do it on scurvy, but I did vitamins projects, because I did nutrition, which was a, shitty class. But it was a shitty class because of personalities. Maybe edit this out. I hated that fucking professor so much. You know what? She's never going to listen to this. Fuck her. I hated her.
That's crucial. Yes, another survival tip. Make sure you diss your professor in a public thing, but only after you pass the class.
Hey, survival tip. Use rateyourprofessor.com, and if they all say she's mean and she hates people, like, don't take her class. Take another professor's class.
That is a good one.
Anyway, lemons.
Yes, lemons. Lemons are great if you don't like scurvy, and I don't think there's anyone in the world who likes scurvy. Scurvy is caused by a vitamin C deficiency, and that restricts the body's ability to produce collagen. And if you can't
deficiency.
Make collagen, it means... Did I say deficiency?
Vitamin deficiency. Do you get it?
God!
Continue.
I can't believe you interrupted my excruciatingly researched scientific information to make a bad pun. Actually, now that I'm saying that, I fully believe it, and this is really in character. I'm moving
I'm so
on.
Proud of me.
So, if you don't have collagen, that means that your tissues literally start breaking down, which, as you can imagine, is not a great look. So what exactly does that mean? Well, are you familiar with the Alt-J song Blood Flood?
Oh my god, no I'm not.
Anyways, bleeding gums, bleeding inside your joints, bleeding under your skin. The book also mentions bleeding eyes and anus. I didn't see anything about that on Wikipedia.
I do believe at this point they had a lot of reasons to just be bleeding from the eyes and anus.
Yeah, it's like, I'll buy it. I totally, you know what? That's fair, guys. You're having a rough time. Also, your teeth fall out.
Yes.
Your bones and muscles ache all the time, and you lose the ability to think properly. But also, like, you're stranded in the middle of the Arctic for 3 years. That's kind of a given. Like, I don't think anyone's really mentally doing great in that situation.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about vitamin C deficiency, or any of the vitamin C, vitamin B, there's a couple other that are water-soluble, which means that they don't get stored. There's water-soluble vitamins and there's fat-soluble vitamins. Fat-soluble lasts longer in your body because it can be stored in fat, while with water-soluble, they basically, if you have more in your diet than you need, you piss it out. So you can't store vitamin C in your body to nearly the capacity you can store other vitamins. But all deficiencies of vitamin B or vitamin C, they're water soluble. I immediately forgot the term I was using. So sorry. But the thing is, it's so easy to reverse them. Like, if you have a thiamine deficiency, I did a project on that last semester, and it's basically like, if you have a thiamine deficiency, literally just changing your diet for a couple days can reverse the effects of crippling diseases. That there's a lot of, you see historically, a lot of problems with navies and water-soluble vitamin deficiencies. The Japanese Navy, for example, had a deficiency, I don't remember what they called it, but other nations called it peri-peri, that killed thousands of Japanese soldiers until eventually this Japanese naval officer figured out that by changing the diet to something that was more like a Western military diet, that these deaths could be immediately dropped. From, I'm talking, wow, a degree of, like, on the ships, that were, like, in this experimental mode, the ships that had the new diet lost zero people to peri-peri, while other ships who had the old diet were still losing hundreds. So,
wow.
Yeah, diet deficiencies, diet vitamin deficiencies are fascinating, because literally if these guys had found a fucking random lemon and sucked it down, like, it could have not reversed, like, you can't get your teeth back, you know. But it would, it's pretty easy to stop the progression of vitamin, of these vitamin deficiencies if they could have just gotten fresh food. And
God.
Yeah, it's actually, it's really interesting and really sad.
Okay, a slight addendum then to our previous, suggestion on, surviving the Arctic by not going to the Arctic. Maybe just don't go on a ship. Just like, don't do that. Like, after reading this book, if you put me on a boat for more than 6 hours, I'm just gonna be shoving lemons in my mouth like some kind of citrus vampire.
You're gonna piss it out. I literally just said that.
Sarah, I don't care, okay? I'm scared. I don't want my teeth to fall out.
Ooh, actually, here's a thought.
I really don't like that tone of voice you're using right now, because I know that it means that something's coming that's not gonna be good.
Of lemons, because lemons might go bad, right? So you eat all your lemons up front, and then you pee them in a jar, and then you save that jar. Is that jar full of vitamin C?
Sarah, would you believe that I was literally going to ask you that question when you first started talking about that? And I was like, no, that's too crass.
I'm gonna Google right now, vitamin C from piss.
You do that, okay? Should I continue talking about other things that can help people survive in the Arctic in the ill-fated situation that they somehow managed to get there?
Well, I just found an article that says the vitamin C pee myth.
Oh God, please just tell me. I just need to know.
You know what? I'm gonna read it. You say all your stuff. I'm gonna ignore it, and then I'm gonna come back to you. No, I can't. This is a very dense article.
You're like, wait, there's actual science here.
Huh. It looks like they're suggesting that you don't immediately just pee out all your vitamin C. But it looks like it's a complicated science thing where the answer is going to be a little nuanced. So let's fuck that.
Not on this podcast.
The point is, if you drink your piss, you will survive for a long time. In fact,
yes, absolutely. That is a fact.
It reverses the effects of aging. It reverses.
It'll grow your teeth back.
It'll grow your teeth back. It'll just seal up that bleeding anus. Unfortunately, it will just be now a smooth, you lose the ass crack. It just becomes a smooth curve.
I can see that leading to many problems, but we're going to move on now. Do you have any cool, sweet survival tips that don't involve drinking your own urine?
Okay, let me just knock off several entries from the list. How about this one? If you're going to be in a dangerous situation and you also realize that you haven't revealed most of the necessary information to explain what's happening in the book, psychic powers sure are cool.
They're pretty convenient.
Yeah.
If only everybody who explored the Arctic had them.
Yeah, because let me tell you, the one person who has an okay time does have psychic powers. So in the back half, starting sort of around the halfway point, we get references to one character having a psychic ability that he's had since his childhood. And there's a bunch, so it is set up to a degree, but it takes, in the last third, I'd say, of the book, maybe the last fourth, really very close to the end, it definitely takes over as the narrative device, as we have a lot of information to get through, and we need this European to be able to talk about Inuit mythology, history, religion, to a degree where it's just sort of like, well, you have Inuit characters, just make them a viewpoint character. You don't have to make this European psychic. There's a very cool character who is an Inuit woman who is... she's an interesting survivor in this Arctic world from an entirely different perspective from all the other characters. She actually knows how to survive at all.
Well, and there was a lot of, like, gender stuff as
Ooh,
well.
Oh boy, the gender stuff.
Especially
hey,
appreciate.
Let's talk about my favorite phrase in the entire novel, which is her breasts bobble. To which you texted back immediately, booble, and...
that was the best joke
it
I
did
ever made.
Derail my entire reading of the book for a bit. Or can we also talk about the weird motif of women's pubic hair?
Yeah, that was kind of a weird theme that popped up almost always.
Bizarre. I've never particularly thought of that as an important part of my own characterization, but I realize now that if a man was narrating my naked body, he'd be like, yeah, I learned a lot, man, just from the grooming.
Also, there's this one scene where one of the characters sees the female character naked, and Dan Simmons makes damn sure that you know that he could see both her boobs and her butt at the same time. Like, don't worry, guys. I know that's, like, the thing you're most worried about in this situation where you see this woman communing with this demon thing. All right? You can see the boobs and the butt, okay? I know.
The boobs and the butt. I can't stress enough how, weirdly erotic this is. This character, the main character's hard on right now, the viewpoint character's hard on right now, is really hard. It's so hard. It's hard as the Arctic ice.
Okay, I was kind of into the horror and eroticism.
You know I was, too. You know I was into that fucking weird polar bear makeout sesh where they're singing with each other's throats and, like, this fucking man is just watching with his giant turgid penis being like, this is the only good thing that's happened to me for 2 years.
Oh, man, why didn't you write this book? this is good shit.
Got any big takeaway survival tips that you want to get out there?
Actually, I have a pretty good one. So within like the first 20 pages or something, one of the characters talks about it being so cold that their teeth explode.
What the?
And I was immediately
yes. Oh,
like,
oh god, I remember that.
Yeah, I was like, that sounds fake. So I Googled it, and I was initially directed to a website called Dental Fear Central.
Oh god, no.
Which I love.
I live there.
And actually, yes, always. That's my train stop. And actually, that website, it pinged because it had the question of, from this book, somebody else asking, is this legit?
Presumably that in all caps and with 7 exclamation points.
Like, I haven't been to the dentist in 5 years. My teeth really hurt. I'm so scared. That's true. That's a true life story. Anyways, so that led me to an article on the BBC, so you know it's legit. The article was called The Gruesome and Mysterious Case of Exploding Teeth.
Oh, no.
So, it turns out that among all the other fucked up shit that was happening in the 19th century, your teeth could literally explode. There were multiple cases of people's teeth exploding. Not necessarily in regards to polar exploration, although there were people saying, like, polar explorers saying that they had experienced that. But even people, like, you know, that it could be kind of verified as much as, you know, you can say now that something in the 19th century was verified. People said this happened. So the theory behind this is fucking insane and I love it. So the theory is that a poorly done filling could actually create an electrochemical cell which would functionally turn your mouth into a low-voltage battery.
Oh my god.
Which I guess would be, like, super convenient if your phone's dying. You know, you're just like, oh, hang on. It's like, ow. Okay, just a sec. Okay, cool. Yeah, no. Okay, let me text the Navy where I am. Okay, great. I'm so glad that this is a factor.
Hey, should we have just asked an Inuit person what's up? No, it's cool. I made a battery from my mouth.
So apparently, metal fillings were sometimes composed of 2 different metals, and as a result of that, it could actually cause something called spontaneous electrolysis. So, you know, in case you're worried about spontaneous combustion, it gets better. There's even more things that can spontaneously happen to you. So, if the filling with these 2 different metals was done poorly enough that part of the cavity remained, which seems in line with my understanding of 19th century dentistry.
Of course.
Then that could actually cause hydrogen to build up within the filling, which could then theoretically be ignited by a cigarette or a spark from a metal casing, causing it to explode.
Hey, Amelia?
Yes, Sarah?
Yeah, I don't like that.
Yeah, I don't like it either.
I don't think that's a good thing to happen in your mouth. I think that's a bad thing that could happen in your mouth. And I don't like that it happened enough that it was a phenomenon that we can write about.
I have to agree with you. And I really have to stress that I'm super glad I don't live in the 19th century.
I have shitty teeth.
Your teeth are so
bad. My teeth are really bad. They don't have any enamel. They're pretty much just loose nerves floating around in my mouth, like cilia, just bringing food to me. I already think to myself, man, I have to replace literally every single tooth with a tooth over that tooth. But now I can add, oh, in another world, I could also just fucking explode my teeth and, I don't know, probably not die. Because if there's one thing I've learned about the fucking 19th century is that a lot of horrific shit can happen to you and you'll die from it, but you're also probably not gonna die from it and you'll just live with it. And that's the fucking worst. Don't live in... That's my survival tip. Don't live in the 19th century.
Oh god, that's such a good survival tip. Yeah, everybody write that down.
Write that, fucker
really,
down.
Really good.
If anyone's like, yo, I got a magic police box, let's go back in time. You go, motherfucker, you take me forward in time and not to those dystopias. Nuh-uh, I want the resort planets. I want the planets where we say exploding teeth and they say, what do you mean? And we go, nice.
All right, well, to be fair, though, if you lived in the 19th century, you'd probably just have no teeth, you know?
If I lived in the 19th century, I would have died about age 5 because I would refuse to eat anything that looked gross.
Yeah, you know what? That's fair. And I would have died in the Arctic because I didn't know what the fuck I was doing.
You would have eaten a person.
You're right.
In fucking cheap side of London.
If I eat a person in the Arctic, you know, oh, sure, that's fine. If I eat a person in London town, then suddenly it's a big deal. This is such a fucking double standard. Hey, I learned some cool polar bear facts. Do you want to hear them too?
No, we should probably end the podcast.
But then I learned a lot of really cool polar bear facts.
You get
facts.
3. I'm going to say goodbye as you say them. No. Well, that's been our podcast. Okay. Amelia,
right,
do you have any thoughts?
An average male polar bear
yes, you do have some
about
facts.
800 to 1,500
that's
pounds.
That's too big.
Isn't that fucking crazy?
That's too
crazy.
Big.
That's so big. They will hunt people for food because they are not scared of people because they're like, what is that? It just smells like a walking French fry. I'm not joking. Like, since there's so few people in the Arctic, they're just not afraid of them, really.
It makes sense. Honestly, when like bears are afraid of humans normally, I'm like, I get that we have guns, but you should never be afraid of me. I can't do anything to you. You're so big.
When I was looking up polar bear facts, the first article that came up was titled, Polar Bears Are Not Bloodthirsty Killers. Just don't forget your guns.
Okay, but if you said that about, like, my neighbor, I would move.
Yeah, that is a good point. Whenever you have to stress the fact that something is not a bloodthirsty killer, that's kind of a bad sign from the get-go.
Anyway, oh, God, like, my name is Sarah, and...
So also, another God. Polar bear fact. When I was looking up, do polar bears hunt humans? The next suggested result was, do polar bears hunt in packs? Which is a fucking terrifying idea. Oh my god.
Well, my name
and
is Sarah.
The answer is no.
Well, my name is Sarah, and I,
most things can outrun a polar bear on land because polar bears overheat super quickly.
That
same.
Makes a lot of sense. My name is Sarah, and I overheat really quickly.
Do I really have to end the podcast? I still have more polar bear
Please
facts.
Say your name, and let's go home.
My name is Amelia, and I really like polar bears, and they are not bloodthirsty killers, and they are pretty cute.
My name is Sarah, and I would die at a polar bear's hand. This is my prophecy.
You've already said your name 5 times.
My name is Sarah. My name
is
Sarah, and I'm just doing my best with the shitty friend that I have. I love you all, except the person that I'm talking directly to. Okay, good night, goodbye, don't go to the Arctic.
Good night, goodbye, don't go to the Arctic. This has been Cracked Spines.